internationally acclaimed leading Australian garden designer, and these are his Garden Rudimentals, a blueprint series on the basics of garden craft.
Paul Bangay, hello.
Hello.
What a beautiful spot this is.
I know. I mean, this is one of my favourite parts of the garden.
Where are we?
Well, we're in the woodland, and it was created probably 5 years after I created the bulk of the main part of the garden. And it was just in a phase when I was sort of emerging from my formality of the parterre and thinking, actually, you know what, maybe I don't need to be so formal. Maybe I need to embrace a little bit of sort of softness in my life. And the result of that is this woodland glen.
Well, the formal touch in this is, I guess, the lawn before us, which is
perfectly circular. Yes. and kind of perfect.
And mowed in very straight lines.
Yes, that's our gardener Tim is like responsible.
But around that, there's this wonderful gentle chaos of leaf texture and shape and hue, beautiful greens all around us.
So, when I came here, we created a garden in a paddock in full sun. And ever since I was a young boy, I just loved the idea of woodland plants, some more tender plants, more casual plants. And I couldn't grow them because I didn't have shade.
These plants need the shade here.
And they need the shade and they need the protection. So what we did was create a woodland by planting lots of these sugar maples and pin oaks and then planting around the outer part of that evergreen shrubs, which provide wind protection. So we're protected from the hot northerly winds and we have lots of shade. And it created this wonderful microclimate that we have today. And then I was able to grow all these sort of really soft woodland plants like the Solomon seal, the petasites over there, the hydrangea paniculatas, ligularias, hostas, dogwoods, all these wonderful sort of cooler climate plants that we couldn't plant before.
That's such a clever planting though. So we have the lawn, we have the plants you've just described, the trees and then the shrubs, and the shrubs give it this background fill.
Yeah. Well, they're doing two things. They're like providing shelter to the garden, but they're also creating great depth, aren't they? I mean, if you look here, you know, shadows give you depth.
Like that woodland goes forever.
That's exactly right. And really it only goes about 8 or 10 meters, then we're back out in the paddock again. It's all an illusion.
So you say this was part of your struggle out of the your strictly topiary previous existence.
Well, you have to remember I'm a product of the 1980s. Like, you know, I started designing in the 1980s when Australia was, well, the world was, you know, very much into formal gardens. And they were obsessed with sort of geometry and straight lines and grids and all those sort of patterns. And that's when I first started creating gardens. And I really admired Italian gardens back then. I loved the idea of formal Italian gardens. And so a lot of my gardening skills came from back at that period. But of course, the world's changed. Formality is not so, it's unfashionable now to be formal. It's unfashionable now to draw a straight line.
Apart from the lines and then maybe a bit of the way you treat the plants, I mean, there's still a formality in this apparent sort of wildness and you know, an untrammeled sort of garden. It still has to be put in place. It still has to be thought about, which is a formal process in itself.
I think probably a little bit, but I think that we're trying to get to a place where the garden really dictates what we're doing. It's not us dictating what the garden does. And so, you know, having layouts that are very soft and informal, but then letting the plants sort of move around the garden the way they want to, not the way we want them to. So I think that the formality really is disappearing. And in terms of the layout, I mean, it is very hard to draw an informal garden. Like, much harder than drawing a formal garden. Straight line is much easier to draw than an organic shape.
Well, especially if you're, you know, if, as you say there, it's so elegantly to let the plant sort of express itself.
Yeah.
then you've got to, I guess as a designer, you're sort of sitting back a little bit from that.
Yeah.
Then.
I think as a designer, but more probably as a gardener, for gardeners to let go of their tendency to go out and snip things or pull out things if they're in the wrong spot. It's one thing for us to design it, but then you've got to express that to the gardeners, you know, to allow them to move around the
but
way
to
they
get
want.
To get the sort of balance that I can see here in the way in which everything has its place and every plant that I see is expressing itself in a way that's not, you know, running all over its neighbour. There's a fair bit of trimming and clipping going on there.
No trimming and clipping. Trimming and clipping that goes
perfectly
in
positioned.
It is. So, I mean, you're probably correct in the fact that when we first plant the plants, we plant them in small clumps. And there's a sort of, I guess, a little bit of formality to the positioning of those. Mm. I mean, in the fact that you have to have the smaller ones at the front and the taller one, the medium ones behind that and the taller ones at the back of that, otherwise we wouldn't see anything. But what those clumps do is they just over there, because this garden's about 15 years old, they're just slowly intertwining with each other. Probably doesn't look like that to you, does it? Because there's distinct groups there. But they are sort of growing underneath each other a little bit and moving around the back of each other.
I mean, that is a tricky thing in gardens, though, is giving everything its space.
Yeah.
And knowing, I guess, you know, what that's going to be in advance is hard.
Well, and that's what, you know, that's part of being a garden designer. You have to know, is this plant going to grow too tall? Is this plant going to be too invasive? Is it going to take over completely?
So the next step along from that sort of retreat from formality into something which has this pleasant plants wandering about sort of feel is to then embrace a certain wildness beyond that.
Yeah. And wilding is the big hot term at the moment.
How do you do that?
Well, I mean, wilding is just really just letting nature do what it wants to do. So taking a piece of land, for instance, and not doing anything to it, just letting some trees grow wherever they want.
How is that a garden?
Well, it's a very good question. It comes back to our definition of a garden, doesn't it? We're letting nature do the gardening and we're not really doing anything. I mean, I would imagine you'd probably have to clear around your house, be done with bushfires and those sort of things. But just allowing the landscape to rewild and be what was there before.
Can we embrace that in an urban setting? Can we recreate that feeling, I guess?
That's a very good question. It probably has to be artificially created there, doesn't it? I mean, we're not going to clear our little courtyard and hope that trees are going to pop up wilding themselves all over the place.
I guess the nice thing, and you still, in this garden at Stonefields, you have this balance in spades between the formality and the looseness. I mean, to combine those two in a space, if you have the luxury of that space, it's a wonderful counterpoint.
Yeah, it is. And I think that this has been a recipe for garden designers for a long, long time. You can create a formal layout, but then you can overlay that with a very informal planting scheme and allow that planting scheme to actually really soften down the formality of that layout, let the plants creep out. And a big thing now is gravel gardens, where you cultivate the earth, put gravel down, plant pockets of plants in there, and let those plants, you know, really grow through the gravel and move around quite freely. And the advantage of that is you can use the gravel for entertaining on, for walking on, and for letting your plants grow through. So you've really lost the definition of a garden bed.
Keeps the weeds down.
And it does keep the weeds down. But of course, as part of wilding, we've got to accept weeds.
Well, tell me about that, because I think that's such an interesting thought.
Well, it's very hard for me, but there are some beautiful weeds. I mean, I think, you know...
What is a weed? Is there a formal definition?
I suppose, yes. It's an invasive species that's to the detriment of the garden or the landscape, you know, and there are, you know, we've got to be careful, because there are some really nasty weeds that we do need to get rid of in this country, gorse and blackberry and all those sort of things. But there's some beautiful weeds, dandelions, for instance. People, you know, the weed killer came out as soon as we saw that in the lawn. Now it flowers. It's quite beautiful. The little Bellis perennis, that was beautiful in the lawns, but that was often under attack. Now we embrace that.
So people, I mean, is that a discernible trend in garden land?
Oh, it definitely is, yes.
I'm intrigued. I mean, the idea of formality and that very sort of French period of parterres, which was sort of the pinnacle of that as a moment in gardens. I mean, where did that come from? What was that a reaction to, do you think?
No, it was the Renaissance, wasn't it? It was like, you know, it was man dominating nature. Did it come from that? Did it come from, you know, the architecture? Was it the feeling of the architecture and how they sort of did proportion and scale and all those sort of things? I guess it was. But, I mean, we've been here before. We had all that Renaissance formality in those French gardens. They started in Italy and went to France and then went to England. And then Capability Brown came along, swept them all away and bulldozed them all and just put in parkland. So we went from formal to informal, and then we went back to formal again. So now we're going back into informal. So it's definitely a fashion, isn't it?
What was his thinking about that, Capability Brown? I mean, what was his philosophy that he wanted to describe to people?
He wanted to feel this feeling of Arcadia. He wanted a natural landscape. He wanted to create this sense of this pastoral sense of how beautiful a landscape could be that doesn't look like it's been created by man.
Hmm. Okay, so wilding, but with a human touch.
Yeah, we're definitely with a human touch. Yes,
I mean there is something about a space like this. I'm fully expecting nymphs and satyrs
to pop out.
Yes.
that's another very good point, because you know once upon a time we would have had statues of nymphs and satyrs everywhere.
Yep.
Now ornamentation is way out. No. The garden is to be devoid of all ornamentation. The only thing to appear now is water in some form.
I'm worried about the rules. Gardens.
No, but I mean, when we were doing formal gardens, you know, a focal point of a statue or a focal point of a group of pots was a really big thing. Now we don't have focal points so much. You know, we have beds that sort of are very soft and organic, and so there's no straight lines. There's no sort of focal points to place something at the end of.
Have you ever gone back to one of your gardens from that period and... Okay,
let's rip it out.
Yes.
No. There are a few still surviving, funny enough. So I quite often get called back to gardens I did 35 years ago.
And how does that feel?
I quite enjoy it. I quite enjoy it. I mean, it's nice to think that the garden, you know, I one of the things I like to think I do is create gardens that are timeless. Like, you don't feel the need to pull it out 20 or 30 years later. So it's wonderful seeing people embrace gardens that were created back then.
How will this space grow? I'm trying to, you say 15 years?
15 years, yeah.
So let's take this forward another 50.
Well, I think the big thing here was that we... Like most people, we're very impatient. We overplanted the trees to get instant shade. So we're greatly editing now because the trees are getting too big. So I would like to think this garden could stay fairly similar to what it is now, but we may have to remove some of the trees in the foreground as the trees in the background would grow over the top of it and still provide that shade. But there's no reason why this garden can't endure for 100 years.
And this is a garden too, which would be richly seasonal.
It's very, very... I mean, we get... You know, we're seeing quite a bit of flower now. We're seeing the hydrangea paniculata out in flower and the pedicytes in flower. But in spring, it's absolutely spectacular. But in autumn, it really shines. Well,
autumn, I was thinking. Yeah. We're surrounded by so many leaves here, which would be...
We are.
Be Connecticut. Writ small.
The pin oaks, the sugar maples, bright, vivid red. They're wonderful colours. I mean, it's a very seasonal garden because we have spring, spring flowers, summer flowers, autumn foliage, and I love it in winter. I mean, winter's my favourite time in the garden.
And that perhaps is maybe, and this too depends on where you are and the climate in the place in which you have your garden. But the formal garden, its rebellion against nature is also a rebellion against seasonality so often. It's a thing which is a constant.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's primarily created from evergreens, you know, English box, yew in Europe or other types of hedging here. So it was very much a garden that was created. I mean, it started in Italy where you can have, it was easier to have evergreen gardens. And of course, out here, it's very easy to have evergreen gardens. So you're right, it doesn't change. But when you say that, there is seasonality in those gardens, the flush of new growth in the green in the spring. It's a very subtle change, but there is seasonality there. You can look for it carefully, but it is there.
You mentioned that flush of green. I asked you before because your parterre here is of box, and it is millimetre trimmed impeccably and in beautiful order. And I wondered how much upkeep that took.
Well, see, there's a misconception that formal gardens are a lot of work. In actual fact, they're very easy to look after because our parterre we trim once a year. So
stop there.
Once a year.
So we treat that, we clip it once a year, and it's pretty static. It stays the same for the balance of the year. And the other thing, formal gardens are very good for small spaces because, you know, it's very hard to plant a plant in a small space and it not to get too big for that space. But if you're constantly clipping it to the one size, then you can maintain it like that forever.
I'm just wondering what's going on in the mind of those poor plants.
Do you think they suffer? Well, not as much as a bonsai.
Yeah, indeed. Whereas in a space like this, the work would be, you know, there's a reasonable amount to keep things tidy, to pick up the discarded and the old and the dying and you know,
yeah,
nurture these things.
That's right. And some of the plants have to be cut back in winter. You've got a dead head. You know, you've got to make sure the clumps don't run too much. You might have to split them up and divide them every now and then. So there is a lot more work in this garden than there is in the formal parterre garden.
Your garden here is exquisite, but I think this... Actually, there are a few spaces that I would rate as my favourite space, but right now...
You're happy here.
This is most excellent. Paul, thank you.
Pleasure.
Paul Bangay, his Garden Rudimentals, once a month here on Blueprint and gathered for you, for your listening pleasure anytime on the ABC Listen app.